Did I hear the call in as KF7BH? QIZ, KQRIW?
KF7, Victor November Hotel.
Okay, Victor November Hotel, what is your name, sir?
LANCE, Lima Alpha November Charlie Echo, Lance, Reno, Nevada.
And Lance, are you checking in because you have a question or a comment tonight? Go ahead, Lance.
This is a new net. I just was considering what is going to be entailing of a tech nature. According to ILP information, it's a real technical tech net, which I might enjoy. So I will listen to part of it, and I may disconnect if it's not of the right nature, okay?
Pretty fine, Lance. And you, as you're about to find out, we try to do both. The tech net starts at 8 o'clock each Sunday night for the last 30 years. And for the last 10 or so years, it runs for 4 hours. The first hour is slightly lighter material. The second or third hour is where we dig into the more the deeper technical material. A person signs into the technical net by giving KQRIW, that's Dick, that's me, or John, KC2WGB, we're the two pet control people. You give us your call letters, your name. That means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Let me drop. We make a sincere effort that during the first hour, a person shouldn't have to wait longer than an hour. The people who sign in the beginning will get at least a brief answer to their question or comment. At the end of that hour, Paul, WS2N, well, first, John, KC2WGB, goes to the mailbag, where people who don't have their ham license yet ask questions, and if they've got a general question, a question of general interest to the group, we handle that question. And then Paul, WS2N, gives us the space report, telling us what the latest that NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has been doing. After that, we go into deeper material, and one of the things we've been going into lately is the creation of a model, our own model, of what a radio wave really looks like, because John and I and Glenn are somewhat doubtful as to whether or not the current model is accurate. We think there's ways of improving it. Let's give you a little bit of a rundown. The main purpose of the technical net is education. How does all this wireless hardware really work? Transmission lines, antennas, receivers, synthesizers, propagation, moon bounce, and meteor scatter. There's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. And 2-meter repeater ham radio, the one you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. And so it's a fairly vast educational hobby that a person is displeased with the first one that he became accounted with back in 2020 when he becomes accompanied to, here we go, you know what I'm trying to say, try one of the other 26 or 25 to see if it'll please you. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-in. So if you have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not to sign in. I mean, there are some nets where people will go through a long list of people to sign in to say they're listening.
K2AMZ, Mike, and I do have a question.
Yes, well, I want Joe. Yes.
Okay, I didn't pass it over for questions yet, but it's very good. K2RYY, AMZ. We got Mike and Joe. So what I'm saying is that we don't need a long list of people just signing in to say they're listening, because after 30 years of the technical net, we believe somebody is listening. The technical net, this particular repeater in New York City, W2VL, covers a good fraction of the tri-state area, which is New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And as such, there's a lot of brain power in that area, and we try to tap into that brain power. Hopefully, when people hear John and I discuss our first guess as to what an answer is, and people in that area have experience in those particular areas, we'd like to believe they will chime in and correct our errors. There's no guarantee that everything here on the technical net at first is 100% accurate. The price is right. You didn't by going to the website www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and for the last 6.5 years, you can select the year, the month, the Sunday, and which one of the hours, since the TechNet lasts for 4 hours, it's in 4 separate reels per Sunday, and you can select which one of those reels you want to listen to. In the past 5 or so years, the material was being documented every 10 minutes. On that website, you can read what was the subject matter being discussed. Well, that turned out to be a pretty heroic effort, and that came to continue for the time being. So now you just have to listen to them all sequentially. Some people are unable to stay up for the whole 4 hours of the TechNet. It goes on until midnight, and because they got to go to work the next morning. I'm one of them. And as such, what some people will do instead is to go to sleep at, say, 10 o'clock, and let me drop. They go to the website. The most recent weekend of website, here we go, of TechNet recording, within a couple of days of that actually appear on the website. They don't appear instantaneously. So the particular one you're looking for may take a couple of days to show up. Then they download it to whatever recording device they've got and play it to themselves during rest periods or while they're driving or commuting or on their lunch period or whatever. So there's various ways by which a person can hear the entirety of the TechNet, even though they don't have the ability to stay up that late. Okay, so far we've got 2 check-ins with what we believe are real questions or comments, and that's Mike and Joe. Anyone else, give me your call letter name at this time. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2BHY, Jim and Yes.
Okay, yeah, Jim. One of the things I keep making mistakes, I believe your call letter is a Kilo Delta 2BHY. I sometimes call you Kilo Charlie. Is it Kilo Delta, Jim? Go ahead, Jim.
Kilo Delta to Bravo Hotel Yankee. That's a common mistake.
Yeah, occasionally, what people do by mistake is to start talking and then press the button. And so the first couple of letters of their call letters get dropped, if you know what I mean. Okay, so we've got Mike, Joe, and Jim. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Of course, if you have a question or a comment tonight, please give them your call letters and name right now. KQLIW.
Kilo Bravo 2, India, Quebec, November. Chris, yes.
Dick. Good evening, Dick. Okay, I heard Chris. I heard someone say, good evening, Dick. Who was the person who said, good evening, Dick?
It was me that just said your name, just to make you totally aware. There's a slight hum on your microphone audio if you can listen to yourself.
WS2N, base report. Okay, I got Paul, and I think Joe was telling you about a hum on my microphone. And I wonder if we're talking about a PO tone. Stand by, will I turn off the PO tone? See if that's what it is. That's not the PO tone. Stand by. Okay, I'm hearing the same hum coming out of the repeater, whether I'm transmitting through it or not. Let me drop. Yeah, there is a PO tone on the output of the repeater, and that possibly is creating a little bit of a confusion there, Joe. Chris, let me ask you, how much time will you be in the area? Because I believe you're a mobile, so I gotta squeeze you in at the right time. KB2 IQN, K2LIW.
I'll be in the area for approximately 1 hour, I believe. Back to net.
Okay, so we gotta try to make sure we squeeze you in during that hour. Alrighty. One last call. Right now we've got Mike, Joe, Jim, and Chris. Anyone else check into the TechNet? Give me your call letter's name at this time.
C2WGB with the mailbag. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, John. Okay, let's get rolling.
10-3-XCN up to 4.
Alrighty, West recognized. Mike, go right ahead with your question or comment. KC2, Alpha Mike Zulu, I think it is. K2LIW.
Comment before the net starts, 6WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
To record or watch the NASA launch of the Dragon spacecraft. 8:35 tonight, which is what, about 20 minutes or so from now. So I have it on the computer. Just to let you know. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let's follow through with that one, Paul. What's your suggested URL? What website address should a person go to so they can hear, so they can watch the NASA takeoff of the Dragon spacecraft? Go right ahead, Paul.
Whatever it is, you go to the NASA website, NASA.gov, and that's their home website. You can see on the main page, NASA TV. Click on that, and it should come right up. Back to you guys.
So www.nasa.gov, and then you go to the TV section, and you'll find that blast off. And I think you're saying it's taking place at 8:30 tonight, about 20 minutes from now. Alrighty. Mike, KT2 Alpha Mike Zulu, go right ahead with your question or comment. KT2LAW, my name is Dick.
8:35, Dick.
Roger, Paul. You got a mic.
Thank you, Dick. And it's Kilo David 2 Apple Mary Zebra, KD2 AMZ. I have a question regarding RFI on my HF rig and my television set, which is a Samsung, and it's touch controls, or those capacitive touch controls. The problem is most prevalent on 40 and below, 40 meters and below. Every time I tee up, the television gets a mind of its own, which is those different things. And it seems to be, sometimes it goes away and sometimes it's there. I am running a Kenwood TF430S barefoot. I'm using an MFJ VersaTuner, the 949E. I'm using a G5RV antenna. And I noticed when I'm using my field strength meter, I'm getting field strength near the receptacle. I figured I had a grounding problem. I moved my ground, and I still have the situation. I ordered a low pass filter from, and I'm going to try that, and hopefully that might help. And I'm not sure if I'm causing a similar experience to my neighbors, but I know it's happening in my home. Any suggestions?
KD2 AMZ. Yes, I do have some suggestions, Mike. I think the high probability exists that you've got a transmitter that's reasonably well shielded. The transmitter itself is most likely meeting the FCC requirements of all harmonics of more than 60 decibels suppressed. By the time your signal is sent through the MFJ tuner, even greater tuning and suppression is taking place. So the chances of your transmitting system radiating a substantial amount of power on a frequency other than the one that you're really using is relatively small. So I think that could be a red herring or a false alarm, or what I'm looking for, anyhow, that's the real thing. How close is your G5RV antenna to the television set and the wiring of the house? In other words, if the G5RV is directly above the house and the total distance between the wiring of the house is 15 feet, and you're going to get strong coupling. And so relocating the G5RV may be required. See, the whole idea of your antenna is to radiate. And if that process of radiation, by the laws of physics, couples signals into the wiring of the house, then you're going to be getting some grief. So that's a good guess. And the fact that it happens on the lower frequencies also is possible. That's where your house wiring has a kind of resonance to it. Therefore, the signal gets enhanced in the house wiring. Too bad somebody doesn't make a convenient field strength meter that you could connect directly to the 110-volt circuit. Although I guess there's various ways you could do that by coupling it yourself to a 10-picofarad capacitor. You'd have to be careful, though. It has to be a capacitor that's rated at a high enough voltage, otherwise the instrumentation in your hand would become hot with the 110 volts, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So my first question, Mike, is how close is the G5RV antenna to to all of the hardware of your house. Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Mike Zulu, KQLIW.
KD2AM, please. I would say the radiating part of the antenna, you know, not the downlink portion, I'd say is at least 30 feet away from my house. I have a relatively small lot here. And the thing is that got me is it happens sometimes, but doesn't happen other times. For the longest time, the problem was solved by taking tin foil, foil tape, and covering up the touch controls and, in essence, shielding them. And then all of a sudden, it reappeared again today for, like, no explained reason. I thought when I shielded the touch controls, I would take care of the problem. I would just use the, you know, the IR remote control, which is totally fine. But, again, it just reappeared, like, out of nowhere for no real apparent reason. That's what really got to me. I thought I put a Band-Aid on the problem. I hear.
Yeah, let me find out a little bit more about what you're saying, Mike. There's some ambiguity in what you said. You covered up the touch controls with tinfoil. Out of curiosity, they have the touch controls that are on the handheld remote control or on the front end panel of the television set. If it is the front panel of the television set itself where the touch controls are located that you're speaking of, the amount of antenna area there, so to speak, is so small that even though when you cover them with tinfoil and it got better, the randomness of the situation led you to believe the tinfoil is making an improvement. Maybe it really wasn't. Maybe it was really being coupled to the 110-volt wiring of the house. Back to you for an answer on that one first, Mike. Go ahead, KQLIW.
Clarification. The touch control, you know, like the old touch lamp, is on the TV. So I covered up the touch control on the television set itself. In other words, I tried to shield the TV control from my RF. I figured that was the problem. And it seemed to have gone away almost immediately until today. And I don't know, maybe because of the rain, maybe if something changed. And again, it's baffling me. I thought that shielding would solve the problem, H2AMC.
Most modern-day television sets have a plastic cabinet, which really is radio-wise wide open. There's a heck of a lot of wiring and printed circuit boards and other things, high-voltage power supplies and whatever, in the television set. I'm now speaking of a capital retube-type set. I guess I should also flip over to the more solid-state sets, but still, the packaging of the thing called television is not that well-shielded. In theory, if it wasn't coming through the 110-volt wiring, you'd have to put tinfoil around the whole package of the thing called television, and maybe even including the display, of course, which would be very difficult. One of the things I would try if I were you would be to try to create an RF choke on the 110-volt wiring to the television set. My first guess is that wiring of your house, which goes on for tens of feet, if not hundreds of feet, represents a very large aerial antenna, a pickup sensing device. And I'm guessing that the signal out of your G5RV is coming through that particular process. And if you could create a choke where it enters the television set, that would help. Radio Shack used to, and I hope they still do, sell these ferrite-like devices. You can open up the jaws of the ferrite-like device, put it over the wiring, and then close the jaws. And that represents a pretty nice RF choke. If the 110-volt wiring to this set happens to have enough length to it, let me drop. You could try making a few turns to it and holding it together as with either tape or a tie wrap to try to create an RF choke. That's a long shot. The fact that the chances of you having a long enough cord, you can make a good enough RF choke out of the 110-volt line cord, it's worth a try, but My first attempt would be to stop any RF energy from coming up the 110-volt line, because I think that's where quite possibly it is coming up. Most people these days are using cable television or the equivalent, and those are usually pretty well-shielded systems. If you are like me, an old-fashioned person who still uses over-the-air television reception, Well, then the coax cable from the aerial on the roof is another a possible place of entry where choking could take place. So I'm guessing you're listening to cable television, and I'm guessing that portion of the system is probably pretty clean. I wonder if you've seen these fluoride-like devices I'm speaking of, Mike, which, correct, yes, Mike, that Radio Shack used to sell. I wonder if you've considered trying that approach. KD2AMZ, K2RIW.
KD2AMZ. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what I did. I had a bunch of those ferrite chokes, and what I did is I did choke the power lead. I had one. I put it on the power lead to the TV. I'm thinking I might be getting it through some of all my other devices, because I have some rather long leads, because my cable box, for lack of a better word, is in a closet. I have remote IR repeaters, etc., etc. You're suggesting basically put a ferrite feed on every wire, in essence, going to the television set?
Not necessarily. I know you've got a whole lot of RCA phono plug things going to the set, and those are pretty well shielded. I don't think you have to worry about those. The output cable from the cable converter to the set, that's usually an F connector, a coax cable. That's pretty innocent. However, you did say something very interesting, and that is you put ferrite beads on the 110-volt cable going to the TV. I would also consider putting 110-volt cable ferrite beads on the wiring to the cable box. The cable box, I think, is also plugged in to the 110-volt line. That is another possible area of ingress of these strong RF signals that are giving you grief. So every one of the cables, I wouldn't do that. You could try an experiment downrange where if you're using a whole lot of your auxiliary inputs for the hi-fi functions and whatever, you could try temporarily disconnecting those and see if the problem improves. But I think your next step is ferrite bead, 110-volt line for the cable box. Now, there are people out there in the ham radio world who have done an awful lot of electromagnetic interference elimination and experience. I wonder if anybody listening to us tonight has a further suggestion for Mike on this problem of the touchtone pads being false alarm by his, let's say, 80-meter signal out of his ham radio rig. He's running the 100-watt level, and he's getting false alarming. If anyone have any suggestions, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KB2IQM with one suggestion, which is concerns the missing filter.
When you say the missing filter, go right ahead, Chris.
Well, you know that the TVs are covered by the FCC, and the TVs today are missing a particular filter because there's an expectation for them to be running on cable. I don't know if there's a possibility that the 80-meter signal could be getting in that way.
Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. In the old days, there used to be a 6-meter high-pass filter. Yeah, a high-pass filter that would include channel 2 and up and hopefully eliminate everything below. That filter used to be installed in every single television set by FCC command. And then the FCC gave permission at the request of the television manufacturers to eliminate that filter to save them some money, but to supply the filter free of charge to anybody who requests it. So the high-pass filter that used to be on the television set was primarily there for the aerial input connector. I don't know whether or not, and maybe that filter was also in line in such a place that when you use the cable TV input F connector, it also had that filter. So requesting that filter from the television manufacturer, if that deal still exists, and I'd like to believe it does, that's a possibility. But it's a, let me think now. Yeah, that is a high-pass filter. It would give you a lot of filtering of the frequencies below 50 megahertz, below 54 megacycles. That's a possible approach. But I think cleaning up the 110-volt line first is a better approach from my point of view. So So I think we've given you a couple of experiments you can try there, Mike. Please do that and come back next week and let us know either the good news or the bad news of what you discovered. Also, let me think now. You don't have enough property. Let me drop a call. I said that you don't have enough property to move the G5RV further away. You probably don't want to go through the rigmarole of changing the orientation of the antenna. If it goes east-west, put it north-south. And for a bunch of reasons, you probably don't want to do that. Any method of changing the dressing of the wiring, the 110-volt wiring, to cable box or television is worth a try. I know it's not easy, but it sure would be nice if you could move the whole system. If it was a small system, you could move it to another room just to see what happens, but now that's out of the question. So further choking of the 110-volt line is my best suggestion. If you actually study the way the touch tone pads work, I think they run at something like 100 kilohertz, but the actual touch tone pads have a 100 kilohertz signal going through a transparent conductor that's under the thing that you press with your finger. As you put your finger there, either it is a membrane type switch, or it is a capacitive sensing switch, which senses the capacitance of your finger in the near vicinity, and it knows if you want to press number four, so to speak. So the chances of that being sensitive to an 80 meter signal, I think, is a long shot. So I again think it's 110 volts. That's about the best I can offer right now, Mike, and let us know next week what you find out. KD2AMZ, K2LIW in TechNet.
Mystic.
Hold on now, Mike. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I had a problem similar to that in my lab with the generators and stuff, and what I wound up doing was I put two 001 3-kilovolt disc capacitors right at the service entrance to my lab, right to ground from each of the hot legs, and that attenuated it greatly.
Could you repeat the what you put on there, John? You put a couple of caps across the hot and the neutral. What size caps?
They're .001 3kV caps, and I decoupled everything, the neutral and the two hot legs, right to ground.
Interesting thought. And I am going, just in case you do it again, I am going to put a ferrite on my box because, you know, I'm using HDMI. The ground of the HDMI cable from my cable box is still connected to, you know, could be coupled all the way through my power system if I don't do that, and it could be coupled right through the HDMI shielding.
EC2WGB. Yeah, that's a good idea, too, to try that. Also, there's problems with the ground pins and ground rods if they get tied together, and you want to make sure you don't pick up a neutral on that grounding when you're doing it. Sometimes that happens. You've got to be very careful with that. They've got to be kept separate. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I turned off the tone by mistake. The way you did the grounding, I have the sense that the normal, the green round pin of the 110-volt socket, that is, some people call it ground or safety. I have the impression from what you're saying, your 001 3-kilovolt capacitors went to a completely separate grounding system, to a ground rod right near your shop. Is that what you're saying, John? KC2WGB, KQLAW?
So, Dick, right at the service entrance where it comes into my garage, which is a second distribution panel, I went right from the neutral and the two hot leads right to the circuit breaker panel case itself. That would be the green wire ground, by the way.
Interesting. And when you take 3-kilovolt capacitors, 001, I'm guessing these are great big green just ceramic-like devices. Is that what they actually physically look like, John? Go ahead.
They're about the size of a quarter, Dick, and they were brown. I believe they were Mallory's. Very small, and they're light enough that if one of them short, they'll just blow apart in the box and nothing will happen.
Out of curiosity, where did you buy those, John? Or don't we have any bucks?
I believe they came from DigiKey. I bought them about 4 years ago. I'm pretty sure they were DigiKey. The Cornell Duplier makes them, and Aravax makes them. There's quite a few, but 83 KV cap and .001, you know, the .002, whatever you can find.
Yeah, in anything in that vicinity of the continent has a rather small amount of reactance to, let's say, an 80-meter signal, and he chose 3 kilovolts just to make sure that there's a whole lot of excess voltage rating, because you have enough that become a short circuit. So 3 kilovolts or above is a strong recommendation. Back to you for any final on this one, my KD2AMC, KQRIW.
KD2RIW, KD2AMC. Those are interesting ideas. The caps right at the service entry, easy enough to do in the, junction box, power distribution box. And I think I'm going to put a ferrite bead choke on all the power that can possibly go to my TV set and isolate that, because I'm convinced that this is a power problem. Because, again, when I took my field strength meter and I walked past every, outlet, and the needle jumped every time, I walked my power system. So I'm convinced it's something that's flowing through my power system, and again, like you said, it's just acting like a big old antenna. I think I have some good ideas, some good things to check out, and I appreciate it, but I'm still going to throw a low-pass filter on the output of my transmitter, because I can't go wrong that way. It couldn't hurt. This is KD2AMZ. I want to thank you very much. KD2AMZ, clear and monitoring.
About 1 minute from launch, Dick.
Roger, John. Yeah, you just said a mouthful when you said you take a field strength meter and you walk near each one of the outlets in the house and the needle jumps. That's strong evidence that your house wiring is hot. And that's the biggest antenna in the system. That tiny little bit of wiring that goes to the actual touch tone pads themselves and shielding that, I think that's the hard way to go. I don't think that's where the majority of the problem is coming from. And you're one of those lucky guys where the physical layout of your wiring of your house just happens to have the right length and position that, for all we know, it is risen at, say, 80 meters. And so there are other ways of killing the resonance of that wiring, but they're very difficult. Let's try choking it first. Good luck with that project, and we'll hear from you next week. My Joe is next, KQRYY. Go right ahead, Joe. KQRYW in the tech net.
20 seconds.
Okay, there's a launch about to take place. There's people who want to watch it. You got it, Joe.
15 seconds.
Yeah. 9. 8.
I might as well leave this thing keyed up.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Launching Dragon to the International Space Station and returning cargo to supply mission. You have the choice.
Looks good, Dick. That'll be rest to us.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And right on time of approximately 8:35 local time. And the launch did take place. So by going to NASA television, you should be able to watch that. I'll go right ahead, Joe, to B2LYY, KQLAW.
Okay. Very good, Dick. My question has to do with oil burners. I brought up the subject before. I think others have. And being that the heating season is coming up, it might be an interesting subject to talk about a little bit. The oil burner I have, it basically says to adjust, it tells you the service, but adjust with instruments. I'd like to know more about this. I'd like to know also specifically what kind of instrument you use to adjust this and where the instrument is placed to be able to get a reading to adjust the oil burner for the proper settings. Basically, as far as that airflow and so is concerned with the oil burner. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach, which I personally disagree with. But not everyone's going to agree with me on this one. You can put instrumentation in the stack and try to adjust the fuel-air mixture so that you get the maximum temperature. And you think you're doing the right thing. There's also devices that will suck out some of the flue gases, put them through a filter, and make a judgment by the coloring of the soot that you get into that filter. And that's an interesting approach. And there's also instrumentation that will measure the various gas components, how much carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, dioxide, and so on. My philosophy on this one is that if you get the finest possible atomization of the fuel, if the fuel nozzle is small enough so that the system is not being partially overloaded, and therefore you can get a significant amount of air going into it, and my philosophy is that if you increase the air to fuel ratio, therefore you run a slightly cooler flame. In the long run, I think you're not ahead because you're not generating soot, and the soot that you do generate in the boiler coats itself on the heat exchanger function, and therefore becomes the world's best insulator. So even though you've made a hotter flame, if it's got a sooty flame, in about a month you've generated enough soot that the flame is now insulated from the water that you're trying to heat, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So my philosophy has been to decrease the size of the nozzle. There's a beautiful website article you can go to, which I'm going to find that article in the next few minutes. I'll tell you guys about it. There's a website you can go to. You read this article about nozzles, but it gives you a hell of a lot of other information about proper setting of the oil burner. And one of the suggestions by the nozzle manufacturer is that if you take the pressure control regulator system that's in your oil burner, turn its little screw so that the 100 pounds per square inch that it normally generates goes up to 150 pounds per square inch, you get much finer atomization, you get much more complete burn, and you generate a hell of a lot less soot, and therefore you burn less oil, the big picture, even though you've increased the air content to the point where the flame is a little bit cooler, if you know what I mean. So I'm going to try to find you that particular website. I think it's Madan or something like that. It's the name of a company that makes, is a major manufacturer of nozzles, and they've got this beautiful downloadable article that goes on for about 30 pages and gives you a lot of information. The price is right. Now back to you, Joe. That's as much information as I can give you right now. If I give you the website for that article, you'll be very happy when you read it. W-H-Y-Y-Y, T-H-Y-Y-W, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. I just thought that if it's being done by instruments, you're doing it with something that's sensing something from the oil burner system as far as maybe minimum or maximum, you know, whatever it was supposed to be as far as the different gas it's sensing, and you're adjusting something correctly. It's like, you know, playing with radio stuff. You want to have instruments when you adjust a radio, you know, for the best performance. I thought that the same thing would apply to an oil burner system instead of trying to do it visually, because I know you can adjust some of the adjustments as far as the airflow and I guess the amount of air that the oil burner will actually pull in, and it does affect the height of the flame and you can make the flame just about go out or appear like bluish at the tips of the flame, and if you go the other way it goes very yellowish and looks dirty look. But I just was asking just to know if there's the best way to do it by interest, but apparently what you were saying, you just do it another way.
Yeah, this is the one case in life that I know of where using instrumentation could, in my opinion, lead you astray from my particular philosophy. Now, is my philosophy the best one, and is it right? Darn interesting question. The website that you go to get this beautiful nozzle information starts off with, I'm amazed, http://, no www, I'm a little bit confused by that one, so no www, NAKCO, November Alpha Kilo Charlie Oscar .com. That gets you in the right area. After that, the / heating _ tip / nozzle % 20 knowledge .pdf. I can send you a copy of this one, Joe. It was KB2MAR last week who was asking this information. So once you know that there is a company, and NAKCO is not the name that's on the front cover of the actual PDF document itself, but once you get a hold of that document, and one way or another, I'm going to help you get that document. It's going to answer 10 more questions that you haven't yet asked about how to get a really clean burn out of your burner. Back to you for any fill-in that required, Mike. There we go, Joe. I'm losing it tonight. H-U-R-Y-Y-W.
Okay, I have a Beckett burner, and I've also heard you mention about the oil pressure adjustment, and I can't seem to find that on the particular application that I have here, the whole setup here. I've looked at the pump assembly, and I don't seem to see what you're talking about. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, because I have heard you mention this before, that the pressure does seem to make a difference as far as how much you atomize the fuel that's being going through the system.
Yeah, I think I've owned a Beckett, I've owned a Carlin, these are the actual brand names of oil burners, and the brochure they give you with it doesn't tell you that one of the screws on the side of the pump assembly is a pressure regulator. You're really turning a screw against the spring that determines whether or not the pump generates 100 or 150 pounds per square inch. Almost every one of the oil burners, the pump assembly, has that, even though it's not announced and not well recognized. The article about the nozzle shows you where it is, tells you about how to adjust it. To really do a good job of that adjustment, you've got to buy a pressure valve, you've got to buy a pressure gauge that you can install into the small diameter copper tubing that goes between the pump and the nozzle, and getting the right fittings to install that thing in the right place. Or in some cases, there's a plug you can remove from the pump assembly and plug the gauge directly into it. So you're going to want this $18 or $20 gauge that you can buy from, can't think of the name of the company now that sells oil burner equipment. All of a sudden, what was that again, Joe?
That wasn't me.
What's the name of the company you go to when you buy oil burner parts?
Blackman.
Give me another name. Blackman is one of them. Give me another one.
How about the same one you've mentioned many times, Sid Harvey? Is that the name you're thinking of?
Give that man a cigar. Sid Harvey. You go to Sid Harvey, and they will sell you a couple of very interesting things. One, they've got a $20, 8.5 by 11, white-covered book that gives you a lot of information about oil burner servicing. You can buy for them for about $18 this pressure gauge that goes up to 300 or 400 pounds that you can install temporarily or permanently if you like, to actually measure the pressure coming out of your pump going into the nozzle assembly. They also sell you a very interesting assembly, which is called the pressure... The bolt that goes top-down through your inline oil filter, you can buy a hollow version of that bolt and install a gauge on top of it, a vacuum gauge, and now by measuring the amount of vacuum that your pump is sensing, it shows you whether or not the inline filter is clogged. And another thing you definitely want to buy is the inline switch. There's a switch you can buy that goes between the pump and the nozzle, which is a delayed turn-on switch, and that delayed turn-on waits until the whole system is up to speed, giving you a clean burn. But the most important thing it does is that at the time the thermostat cuts off your oil burner, it instantaneously stops the flow of oil into the nozzle while the whole pump assembly and 12-gauge blower are slowing down. Under normal circumstances, the slowdown gives you very poorly atomized oil dripping out of the end of the nozzle, making a whole lot of soot and eventually jamming up the system. So you want to buy one of those switches. All these things are very inexpensive parts by my standards. Each one of them is essentially under $20. It makes a huge improvement in the system. And I'll eventually get you a little more information, Joe, on how to get that that nozzle book, you know what I mean, the downloadable 20 or so page book that gives you a lot of information about all these settings and what the benefits of them are. Back to you for any fill.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Back to you for a final show. W-H-U-R-Y-Y. T-H-U-R-A-W.
Hey, 2AMZ. Okay. That's what you're talking about. If you send me a link to this particular way to get this PDF file, could you also include what switch you used? I'd like to use the same. Try to use the same thing. If it's easy to buy, easy to install, or something like that. I've heard you talk about that before, too. I think I'd like to do that because that seems to make a lot of sense. Back to you. 82 AMZ.
very fine, Joe. Go ahead, Mike.
I just I had some extra ferrites in my junk box. Snap one on the power lead that feeds the power to my electronics, you know, the DVD players and the cable players, and just went did a quick QSO with a fellow in Ohio on 7.228, and there was no interference. I think it worked.
Let's hope that holds true, Mike, and that's good news. So, well, you can take your field strength meter and go to each one of your sockets in the house, and it jumps. Certainly says your house wiring is hot, and therefore any 110-volt appliance that directly or indirectly is connected to your television set is a part of entry, if you know what I mean, a place of ingress. And so shielding all of those with ferrite beads sounds like the right thing to do. Congratulations, Mike. Sounds like you're well on the road to finding it, and let's hope that solution holds true for the future. Thank you for telling us. Jim, Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2LIW. Okay. Maybe Jim got called away. Let's go over to the next person. Now, Chris, KB2IQN, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2LIW.
Yeah. I'm
going
to go ahead, but Jim, I think I just heard Jim, so let him take it.
Sounds like somebody's in it without the yell, possibly.
It's M2LU with a question, please.
LU, we've heard you. Jim? Jim, if you'd come back to us, it's possible your PL tone is not turned on because we're not hearing you right now. KT2BHY, K2LIW.
Hey, Dick, I have my PO turned on. First of all, thank you, Paul, for telling the TechNet about the space launch. That was really cool. I watched it. It was very interesting. And my question tonight is about the 1,750-meter band. And I was looking on the Internet about this band, and apparently you don't need a license to operate on it, but you can only use 1 watt. And your antenna can't be that long or something. I was wondering if you had any more information on this band thing.
I should know. What frequency is that on, if you happen to know, Jim? Well, it doesn't matter. No, I don't have any information on that. I know that there are certain frequencies we're allowed to go on. I thought almost all of them required a ham license. So if this one is license-free, it's a new one on me. So the 1,750... meter band. If anyone within the sound of my voice has knowledge about that one, please give us your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Looks like you're the only guy that knows anything about it at all, Jim. How did you find out? What were you reading when you read that the 1750 meter band doesn't require a license and we're allowed to transmit a watt on it? Where did you read that? How did you find that out? Back to you, Jim. K2LIW.
I'm on the Wikipedia right now, and I'm going to read the first paragraph. LOFER, low-frequency experimental radio, refers to experimental radio communication practiced by hobbyists on frequencies below 300 kilohertz as part of the radio spectrum known as low frequency. The practitioners are known as loafers. And that's the first paragraph in the Wikipedia article. I also looked at some other sources, and there are some people that put up beacons on this band. If you look it up, it's pretty interesting. I just was wondering if anyone had any more information on it.
Yeah, 1750 meters turns out to be 171.4 kilohertz. So by normal ham radio standards, that's a pretty low frequency. And I know that in the case of some of these low-frequency bands, like 5 megacycles, and there's also another one in the hundreds of kilohertz, and maybe this is the one, I think they tried to limit the size of the antenna. Put a quarter-wavelength antenna on that band requires a lot of real estate. That doesn't matter. What you're trying to do with a thing that you radiate with is to make sure it resonates. So by using inductors, capacitors, zigzagging, top hat capacitors, loading coils, and so on, you can force and a large range antenna tuner. In fact, I worry a little bit about the fact that the antenna tuners we've got don't go down to 1750 meter band, 170 kilohertz. However, once you get the antenna to resonate, as long as the antenna is the right kind of a feed mechanism with the right kind of a counterpoise, you can fairly efficiently radiate that 1 watt. So Wikipedia's got this. What was your search word in Wikipedia to find this particular website so that others can look at it, Jim? KD2VHY, K2LIW?
Comment on the local business.
Jim first, go ahead, Jim.
But I looked up 1,750 meter band, and then the second link, it says loafer-wikipedia is a free encyclopedia, and beyond that there are a bunch of links on, I'll read one, polymer, 1,750 meter, 1 watt crystal control, CW transmitter, then there's a PDF set that says loafing on 1,750 meters, and that's about the band. It's pretty interesting, and I've been reading about it for a little bit, and the propagation is very interesting.
How did you know to even start looking for 1750 meter band? What was the first clue that gave you a hint to go do that, Jim? Go ahead.
Truthfully, to tell you the truth, I don't remember. I just kind of remember coming across it and just kind of forgetting about it, and I remembered it now, and look it up on Google. It's very interesting. You can find some cool information on it.
Well done. I think I've heard of Loafer before. Let's see what Bill Wiss is going to say on this one. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wiss.
Jim, two days ago I got a quality article from British and Radio magazine, and in 2002 they were playing with something that was developed by hand radio amateurs in the 60s. It is the underground low frequency radio communication. They've been using traditional 88 kilohertz, 88 and a half kilohertz. And in 2002, after a few years of experimenting, they have developed a system that is operating on single sideband at 88 and a half kilohertz. So that's one of the factors. The other one is the submarines operate starting from 9 kilohertz. I wonder if you know what kind of modulation do they use. Enter here.
Yeah, Project Sanguine and the Jim Creek antenna. These were antennas that used very low frequency radio transmission because the signal will go at least 60 feet below salt water and can be picked up by a submarine and allows you to talk through them. It is my belief that it is kind of a slow speed Morse code that's used, but I'm not absolutely sure about that one. So 1750 kilohertz. Now, here we go. 1750 meter loafer, and some of this information was found out by the British magazine. I presume by that I mean Radio Society of Great Britain. Their monthly journal is called Radio Communication, or RADCOM, as the Brits call it. So I guess one of the most recent issues that Wes is referring to is some of that information. That's about as much as we know about that one right now, Jim. But I'm going to look into it a little bit more and see what we can find out. Before we get to Chris out of range, we better get to him in a hurry. KB2IQN, Mobile, K2LAW. Go ahead, Chris.
All right, very good. Thank you, Vivinet. All right, my question is about the model. Believe it or not, turn down the other rig. I'm monitoring the output. All right, so Friday I was doing what I would call a Gedanken experiment, where I was thinking about if the model is the way we think it is, we meaning everyone that's been thinking about it on the net, where you know, you have a current that launches a magnetic field, and the magnetic field is the major thing that's being conveyed over the airwaves. What about what happens when that hits a corner reflector? Now, what I'm getting at here is, I know you were doing some experiments with 10 gigahertz with some aluminum corner reflectors. Aluminum is a metal. It bounces radio waves back, but it's non-ferrous. So, in theory, it doesn't react with magnetic field. So now I'm thinking. So I figured I'd bring it up as a question for the net. KB2IQN, back to net.
Yeah, there's magnetic fields and there's magnetic fields. If I'm talking about a steady-state magnetic field coming out of a bar magnet, for instance, whether or not something that I put in front of it will be affected by it is a function of whether or not that's a so-called ferrous material, an iron-like material. If you put a piece of aluminum in front of a bar magnet, nothing happens. However, at radio frequencies, because of the Skinner effect, because the frequency is high enough that you get a depth of penetration that's very small, most of the radio frequencies we use, the RF energy, when it encounters an aluminum or a copper conductor of, say, an antenna, the radio signal only goes down through the surface about 1/10,000th of an inch. That surface is highly conductive. The surface is so conductive that the signal doesn't get a chance to go very deep. And therefore, you're not using the magnetic properties per se. The fact that the conductor, I can put a copper coil in the vicinity of a bar magnet. I plunge the bar magnet through the center of the copper coil. I induce current and voltage on that coil because the rate of change of magnetic field encompassing the surface of the coil is doing that work. Stand by a second. Some of those crazy sounds you're hearing in the background are coming out of my rig. I'm going to switch over to the other rig, I think. Anyhow, so it is the conductivity of the surface that gives you the radio reflection, not necessarily the pure steady-state magnetic field. A radio signal has got a magnetic field, yes, but the magnetic field is changing so rapidly that this Lenz's law effect or Faraday effect, in other words, the rate of change of magnetic field that a conductor senses generates a current in that conductor. That is a surface phenomena due to conductivity, and the penetration of the magnetic field into the material doesn't take place. That chunk of aluminum I put in front of my bar magnet, that magnetic field is penetrating the aluminum, and it doesn't behave the same way with a ferrous material. But at higher frequencies, we're using surface conductivity, and now it's only the conductivity that matters, not what it's made out of. That's my first guess as to what I think is going on, Chris. What Chris is referring to, let me drop, is that Glenn and Wes and Chris and John and Dick are slowly developing our own version of what we think is a slightly better model of what a radio wave looks like as it propagates through space. Because the current model being used, in my opinion, it's a good model in its day. Maybe it needs updating, and maybe we're completely wrong. We're eventually going to find that out as we proceed along those lines. Back to you, Chris. And your signal sounding good. Where are you located? KB2IQN, T2RIW in the tech net.
Roger, I'm sitting at a pier on the Cross Island Parkway, which is, I decided to stop here for a few minutes to talk to the net because the signal will be good. Yes, I know about the skin effect. I considered that briefly, but what I'm still having some trouble with this. It's the magnetic field inducing a current, I can understand. But the magnetic field inducing a current in aluminum, I can't understand. So that's where I'm just thinking. Anyway, don't have any further comments about it other than the fact that I'm still thinking about it. Back to net, KB2IQN.
Commented.
John recognized, going to pick up John in a minute. That coil, that solid...